Hey Karan, how's it going?
Hey, hi Nikhil. All good. How are you doing?
All well, Karan. So, Sharad, I'm pretty excited. It's been a hiatus, whatever the word is, of
Yeah,
almost a month and a half.
I know. Yeah.
And we probably thought that wave number three might be a good time to kick things off again. And now we are kind of packed with episodes over the next, I think, 1.5 to 2 months.
Yeah, we're interesting, and like you said, we're resuming with a fairly interesting business as well. Something that is, very hot in the Indian marketplace, be it like lending or fintech, whatever bucket you want to broadly put it in. But Karan, thanks for your time, and it's great to talk shop right now.
No, I'm very, very glad to be here, Sarath. I'm glad I'm the one who's the one coming out of the hiatus for you guys, and excited to talk with both of you.
So, Karan, you are one of the co-founders of Kesht, and as well as the chief technology officer there. Obviously, you're you know we always make sure to do an extensive research on LinkedIn, naturally, with all our guests. So you've been at CMU, you've worked at Citadel as a financial technology associate, and now you are a part of a credit of a digital lending business at Kesht. So welcome to our show. And I think to start, the best way would be to understand Kesht, its product, its offering. And we've obviously kind of gone through the website, and we kind of essentially our understanding was that there is a blend of retail level BNPL type of offering within Kesht, as well as some amount of merchant credit, which kind of fits in the broad buckets. So would love to understand your personal journey with the company, as well as the model that is being followed internally. And we can probably follow that up with a few questions and insights on the digital lending landscape at large, because the RBI, the regulator, in mainstream media, I think there are a lot of right as well as wrong notions about how digital lending in general works. So through Kesht, would like to understand the broader landscape out there.
Right, absolutely, and I'll be very happy to, at least give you a background context on what Kesht does, what the landscape is like in India, and how lending has changed over the last 5 or 6 years. So let me start by just giving you a top level primer on what Kesht is, what are the kind of products we run, what's the market we play in. At Kesht, essentially, we are basically a digital and seamless lending company. We largely lend to consumers. These consumers can be both self-employed as well as salaried, which itself was a big difference 6 years ago when we started. Most companies, most lenders, banks are very comfortable lending to salaried people. Self-employed is where it becomes tricky to assess the customer's behavior. This is one of the primary things that Kesht addressed. We started lending equally to salaried and self-employed. Now, the model of lending itself for us has changed over the last 6 years. We originally started as a B2B2C company, and we were doing consumer durable financing, which is when a customer wants to buy either a jewelry from CaratLane, a mobile from the Samsung website, or any item, whether it is hair oil or a pair of scissors from Flipkart. You could buy all of that using an EMI linked purchase from Kesht. We were integrated with a large variety of partners, including Flipkart and MakeMyTrip, the largest e-com and the largest travel website. And we are tied up with every single category leader there is, CaratLane and the Samsungs of the world. The challenge we faced with this model, the B2B2C model, was that the growth was always limited because as much as e-com has taken off in India, a large part of the purchasing is happening in retail physical stores. So we also ventured into the retail store where we were competing with the likes of Bajaj and Home Credit. Super competitive market, but more challenging. It turned out to be a more physical market where you'd have to do some exchange of paperwork. There's a large number of customers did not have means to do digital authentication or digital KYC. So that is a model also that we were not super happy about because it turned out to be digital plus slightly physical. And again, it went against our ethos where you wanted to do truly digital and 100% seamless loans. As an alternative, with a lot of customer feedback, a lot of research, and you know, learnings as we've been building Kisht, we also realized that one of the most seamless ways to do, you know, to have credit made available to customers is in the form of a simple personal loan. Just put the money in the bank account, and the customer will find the best deal for himself. If the customer wants to buy a mobile phone and you only tied up with Flipkart, but the best deal is being offered by, say, Amazon, then you're stuck. Your customer is stuck. You don't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we've also largely, over the last couple of years, we've ventured into what we call small ticket personal loans. So these are personal loans ranging from 15,000 to 45,000, the average ticket size being around something 30,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the beauty of these loans is these are loans which no traditional bank or NBFC wants to do. When you try to do a loan of 30,000 average using a traditional model, the overhead costs are too high and no bank will be able to justify doing these loans. So it was a largely untapped market for us, and we've been able to do these loans in a completely digital fashion. So our overheads are practically zero. We don't have a sales team, we don't have an underwriting team, we don't have a document approving team or anything of that sort. We don't collect physical papers that we have to store in our warehouses for KYC.
Mm-hmm.
We do it 100% digitally and 100% instantly. So when a customer comes to the Kisht app, applies for a loan, the money will hit his bank account within 5 minutes of him having downloaded the app.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you know, just to, you know, just to understand this, how are you decoupling the merchant or the partner from the customer?
Right. So what we are doing is, what we are essentially saying is, see, earlier we were trying to do these merchant loans
mm-hmm.
under the assumption that because the, you know, the loan is tied to a purchase,
mm-hmm.
they are generally less in risk compared to personal loans.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a general thesis, which is why consumer durable loans are generally priced more attractively than personal loans.
Mm-hmm.
We've looked at a lot of the data of our customers. We've actually spoken to thousands of our customers. We've kind of realized that for the segment that we are playing in, for the purchases that the customer wants to do, there is actually no difference.
Right.
Him buying a TV from Flipkart is equally risky, or equally, you know, the same bucket of risk for us as me giving him that exact 30,000 worth of cash loan into his account.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, even though it's a consumer durable loan that we were largely doing, there mm-hmm. is no securitization of the asset for us. So it's not that, that is not how consumer durable works in India.
Right.
There is technically a lien, but that lien is almost impossible to exercise. The legal cost of exercising that lien will be higher than the cost of it at any point of time.
Mm-hmm.
So consumer durable loans behave exactly like unsecured lien. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But like in this, isn't it kind of, you know, the difference being that when it was like a typical consumer durable loan, I mean, effectively the dependency on some sort of a subvention or commission from the merchant is much higher than, you know,
oh, you're absolutely right.
Gaining some sort of an interest margin.
One of the biggest reasons why these loans had, you know, an aura to it, because you were getting a massive subvention from the merchants.
Yeah.
But now when you talk to the customer, let me actually slightly put context to this, right? You're talking about loans that are 15 to 30,000. You're talking about mobile phones largely.
Mm-hmm.
15,000 to 30,000 is generally the ticket sizes that these customers play in. And when you talk about subvention, the difference comes out to 700 or 800 rupees. Okay. Now, if you tell the customer that I have a loan that is 700 or 800 more expensive, but I'll give you the money in your account and you can buy from anywhere. You can buy from a local shop that you can pay him and the mobile will be in your pocket in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Versus telling him that, oh, you can only buy it from Flipkart. We've realized that the customers like this luxury of being able to buy at their flexibility.
Right.
You know, give them the money and then they can also buy some accessories. You'll buy a portable speaker, you'll buy a cover, you'll buy a you know, a mobile bike mount, all of that in, say, a slightly, you know, the slightly higher ticket size loan that you would have given him.
But the credit risk, I guess, is more direct, right, in that case?
Sorry?
But I guess the credit risk or the counterparty risk is much more direct in this case.
For us, yes.
Yeah.
For us, but even in the other case, as soon as the sale is made, mm-hmm. once Flipkart delivers the product to the customer, the risk is 100% ours. Flipkart
right.
plays absolutely no part.
Right.
In helping us recover the money, which is what they would do, right? Ideally, they are facilitating the transaction because we have taken a decision on whether to give a loan or not. The credit risk is always on us.
But currently, it's interesting,
so,
right? Because, there was this one thought that came in my head while you was, you know, saying that I mean, a lot of times what attracts, I mean, I can kind of, you know, vouch for, say, myself, and Sharad, please chip in if you agree. A lot of times, you know, when you see some sort of a BNPL or an EMI plan on any product, you know, you just see very quickly that a lot of these are zero interest propositions, right? And effectively there, I'm guessing the underwriter, most of the money that he or she is making is essentially the commission from the merchant.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Anything that is 0% is generally subvented either by the merchant or by the OEM partner.
Yeah.
Which does tend to be the case, which is why, by the way, Bajaj is so successful in the offline world, right?
Yeah.
Because if you walk into Vijay Sales or a Croma, you will see that there's a Bajaj counter, almost everything is 0% off. There are so many times I have bought things on EMI because when you do the calculation, you realize it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Not only do you get 6 months to pay, but you're actually probably paying slightly less.
Yeah.
Right off the bat itself.
So,
but that model works very well for the offline world.
Right.
One of the things we realize is for the online world, customers don't want to be bound to one or two merchants. Mm-hmm. And they actually, a large part of our customers are taking the loan from us online in our app.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually making these purchases from a physical store.
Mm-hmm. So
also likely because, I mean, that's the other part I'll come to, which is where we are doing we are making a big change in the way we underwrite customers.
So, Karan, just to sort of follow up, is the thinking that since the customer is getting more flexibility, the borrower in this case, is that sort of being reflected in higher cost of financing? Just because, I mean, if you're foregoing some kind of commission or margin from the product side, you got to sort of adjust that in the cost of financing. Is that the sort of play? I mean, at some point, flexibility has to be, you know, you got to pay for that flexibility, right?
So yes, you're right. It's in a small bit, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But let me at least touch on the second aspect, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other big difference Kesh is bringing to the market is we are actually giving loans to a large segment of the customers that nobody else is giving these loans to.
Mm-hmm.
Bajaj gives loans to anyone who's salaried or has a good civil score. We actually give loans to customers who can be NTC, new to credit, who don't have a civil score at all because they don't have a lending history.
Mm-hmm.
And we are very, very happy to give loans to self-employed people as well. Now, these are customers who otherwise did not even have the option of going to Bajaj and getting a loan.
Correct.
So it's not only that they're getting more flexibility, they're actually getting the option to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the big changes we brought to the market, right? We were able to start lending to a segment of customers that was credit deprived.
Mm-hmm.
They did not have the means to get credit simply because the lenders and the banks did not have the means to assess them.
Mm-hmm.
And which is where one of the big technological advantages we've brought to the table is we have this incredible credit and fraud detection engine.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, what it does, it consumes a large amount of data, both traditional data, which is your KYC data and your bureau data. But in addition to that, we also create a very, very rich digital footprint of the customer by tapping into various, close to around 30 different government and non-government databases.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And we're also able to create a digital footprint of the customer by the device on his mobile phone.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to use the data from this footprint to very accurately assess the customer and accordingly price the customer. Even if he's a risky customer, we are able to price them in in a manner where the loans might be on the slightly higher side, as high as 16, 17, 18% for the customer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's versus him not getting a loan at all.
And this is fairly interesting, right? I mean, totally, you guys have identified a credit gap and you're servicing it. In terms of sort of taking it through the tech backbone and trying to decipher as accurately as you can the credit rating or credit worthiness, do you sort of, at a high level, put people in buckets in general, buckets of some bandwidth? Or do you have the ability to actually get into, I mean, essentially I'm asking how granular can you go when you're trying to calculate credit worthiness? Can you go person by person
Correct. So what we are doing is for credit, I'll talk about fraud slightly differently.
Mm-hmm.
For credit, we basically use a machine learning model called XGBoost, a gradient boosting model.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially just spits out a model score, and this score has been trained on close to around 11 million of our loans.
Right.
So it has actually now become incredibly accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Accurate in the sense that at the start of the month, we can tweak our risk appetite and predict what is the loan book we'll be able to build and how much percentage down to the second decimal of that loan book will be delinquent. And I kid you not, it's down to the second decimal, and we've been benchmarking it for, I think, the last 11 or 12 months, and it's proved right every single month, including the COVID months.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what we do with this model score is just for, I think, simplicity. The model score is just a 7 or 8 decimal long variable. We can bucket them into as many buckets as possible, but it's literally like a curve, and we can decide that we want to have a cutoff.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The cutoff that we put in, customers above that will get accepted, below that will get rejected, and our cutoff will also be able to predict what is the percentage delinquency we can expect.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming no frauds are happening, by the way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As soon as you bring frauds into the picture, you know, your thing goes into a toss. So the credit engine has to be counterbalanced by a fraud engine to not let frauds in.
Sure.
Because once you let fraudulent data in, you are assessing the credit of one customer but probably giving a loan to another customer. So that's not going to work out very well.
Mm-hmm.
But assuming that the fraud engine does its job correct, which it does, the credit engine can very accurately predict the delinquency we expect. Now, for simplicity of, you know, just business communication, we break down these model scores into 20 buckets.
Okay.
And every month we decide, you know, what is the risk appetite we are willing to do, what is the business volumes we want to drive, what is the CAC we are okay with for this month, and accordingly we, you know, set how many buckets we want to open up.
Mm-hmm.
If you open up all the 20 buckets, that basically means every single one will get it. But mm-hmm. we usually keep the top 11 or 12 buckets open.
Mm-hmm.
And these buckets are also cross-segmented, you know, by another variable that we've internally created, which is, you know, at a very, very top level, the riskiness for the customer base is the demographics and geography.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the tech is sort of very mobile first in its behavior and design. I mean, I'm just guessing here, but it seems apt for an Indian market. But is that how you sort of think about it as well? Or is a web or on, you know, web browser usage also sort of key to it?
No, it's all largely app driven. So for us, like we get 98.5% of our loans from Android and 1.5% from iOS.
Yeah, right.
Karan, like you mentioned briefly, I mean, this is all, I mean, I assume it's mostly unsecured credit, right? And a lot of them are first-time borrowers. And I mean, when they're first-time borrowers, naturally, they probably don't have a credit card. They won't have much data coming in from CIBIL or anywhere else, and there's a lot of dependency on alternate data, right? Would like to talk a bit about it. It's a big buzzword, you know, which has been going around the blocks, like, you know, for right from social media activity to, you know, you have models in Africa where they're looking at top-ups on prepaid SIM cards. I mean, there are so many ways of, you know, cutting and recutting data and then, you know, building a model around it. But, and like, if you were to, like, for a first-time borrower, what's the you know, underwriting approach that is followed from the standpoint of collecting non-conventional data?
All right. So there are a couple of things. I mean, see, the thing is, in India specifically, and I think very similar patterns exist in Africa as well. In India, what you're witnessing is that almost every business has started having some form of sending communication with the customer in electronic format.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is through emails or through SMS, every transaction you do with your bank triggers an SMS.
Mm-hmm.
Every Ola ride you book triggers an SMS. Every payment you make on Paytm for your electricity bill triggers an SMS. Paying your income tax return triggers an SMS. Not paying your income tax return triggers an SMS.
Right.
And if just coincidentally you go and swipe to your SMS inbox, you'll realize that your entire life history is right there.
Right.
What you've been eating, what you've been, where you've been traveling, everything is right there.
Mm.
So there is a treasure trove of data there. In India also, you know, there is a incredibly large base of Android users where you can actually have access to these this SMS data.
Right.
iOS does not allow any app in the world to access this SMS data. So iOS is just, you know, slightly less rich from that data perspective.
Right.
However, with this massive trove of data, it literally also comes with a massive, massive angle of customer privacy implications,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't want to look at this data in a manner where the customer's privacy is violated. So one of the very cool things that we do at Kicht, which is unlike every other lending app I've tried, and I do try all of them to understand what they're doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
At Kicht, essentially what we're doing is we're reading the data on the device of the customer itself. Our logic, our code to process the SMS data,
mm-hmm.
Besides on the in the Android side of the code base itself, it's run on the customer's mobile phone itself.
Right.
only the variables are transferred back to our servers. And when I'm talking about variables, as in these are all literally very, very highly rolled up variables, whether the customer has been transacting with Uber or not, yes or no, or something like that. But we don't get the raw SMS at all. More importantly, we never read the personal SMS of the customer. You're only looking at the SMSs that are transactional messages, the messages you get from the six-digit sender IDs, right? And we've, at Kisht, I actually generally also play the role of a chief privacy officer. Not that we have a designation, but I'm usually the one who's, I'm myself a massive customer privacy advocate, right? So what I always do is business has requests, my analytics team has requests, the product team has requests. Anything that is going to infringe even slightly on the customer privacy, I shoot down those requests. Only the things that we can do in an anonymous, unidentifiable manner without violating the privacy of the customer is the only things that we do. And I've realized that, you know, the difference between a privacy conscious approach and a less privacy conscious approach is just more work to be done by the tech teams. It does not mean that my model is any poorer. They are doing the exact same effort, but the only problem is that we have to write all of that code in the Android code base rather than in Golang or Python, which would have been much simpler for us to implement. But we've actually done the hard work. We've ported over all of that code to Android and deployed it on the mobile of the customer itself, just to ensure that, you know, the customer's privacy is never violated. Something I'm super proud of, and something, unfortunately, I feel it's a small drop in a big bucket where almost everyone is, you know, extracting as much of the customer's data as possible. But that's an important, I think, step we've taken just to ensure that we are, you know, at least in the right books of the customer.
No, that's super interesting. And like, Karan, like, how do you see the business growing further, right? I mean, obviously, deeper penetration and you get more data points, the model becomes more and more precise over time and, you know, sort of grow the book, essentially. That's, is that the sort of play, or do you see, you know, applications into adjacent, let's not call it sectors, but adjacent growth levers that you can pull with the amount of data that you're able to assess and sort of model? How do you see sort of, you know, next leg of sharp growth?
No, so that's, I think it's a good point, good place for me to touch upon how we're expanding. And I think this coming year, 2022, is going to be a big year for Kisht. There's a very, very interesting market that we've been targeting. And we are, I think, diving headfirst into that now. We've already launched a couple of pilots. What we've been very intrigued, while we've always been chasing the consumer market, right? We do loans only to consumers, never to SMEs. One of the patterns we've noticed that a large number of our self-employed customers, customers who declare themselves to be self-employed, are actually small and medium enterprises. These are, this is your carpenter or your car mechanic, or it's your local chaiwala who's actually taking credit for us to kind of keep rolling his, you know, supply and demand. He's buying produce with the loans he's taking from us and then using that role into his business.
Right.
And we've been quite intrigued by it. We've actually done several surveys and we realized 60% of our customers are actually using what is essentially a consumer loan for business purposes. But these are incredibly small merchants, very small shops or very local kind of self-employed people. We are actually now largely foraying into supporting them. And we are supporting them in a couple of ways. We are actually doing loans for them. But we are also allowing them to start accept payments from their customers using what we are calling a credit QR code. So we are asking these merchants that, okay, the customers who come to you also might be seeking credit from you. They usually have a small credit account with the merchant where they have fee over 10 days and pay at the 10th day. We are saying you can roll that all into our product itself. And the customers can also avail a Kisht BNPL line of credit, we call it later pay. And the merchant can accept payment from this later pay line of credit using either a QR code he's already using or using a Kisht QR code. Also, this transaction data for the merchant that his customers are paying him will be useful for us to enhance his limit as well. So the merchant actually has two benefits. One is, you know, he doesn't have to give credit out to his customers anymore. He can just say that you take that credit from Kisht instead of taking it from me. This transaction history will also help him increase his line of credit because now we have a larger visibility to his business. The benefit for us, obviously, is that this will lead to more customer acquisition. And, you know, these customers who are doing transactions using LaterPay tend to be a lot more frequent. So they end up doing a lot larger number of transactions. They associate with your brand a lot more frequently, and we have intentions to add other products like insurance, as well as bill payments, etc., on the Kisht app. So these customers will become regular transacting customers of the Kisht app.
It's
so
almost
that's
like
one of the biggest.
I know. I was just saying
for us over the next one.
It sort of is almost like some kind of working capital financing, which is somewhat getting secured by receivables, right? I mean, if you put yourself in the place of the, let's call it the local chaiwala, I mean, essentially you're trying to be that, right? I mean, these guys probably need working capital or financing on a fairly regular basis.
Absolutely.
Right?
You're bang on, right? And that's actually where the thesis started, right? You want to do this SME credit.
Yeah.
But SME credit in India is incredibly difficult to do. Just trying to get into what you can call the galla of the shopkeeper, right? Trying to see his receivables has been so far incredibly difficult. There was no chaiwala or panwala who's going to use a mobile POS solution. He's not going to say that, okay, every chai I sell, I'm going to enter into some register, digital or not. A lot of people have tried to solve this problem, but this problem, I don't believe in India, is solvable by any solution by saying that, okay, this is a very cool POS solution we created. You record your inventory, sales and everything you are, and then we'll give you credit at the end of the month. Many, many people have tried that. But we realized that the best way to do it is to link it to another very ubiquitous activity that he's anyways doing, which is he is accepting payments for his customers using UPI now. So we decided that that is how we want to tap into this market. And the UPI amount of UPI transactions that he's doing will be a very, very good proxy for, you know, what is the total business he's doing, what is his credit worthiness, what is the turnover he sees every month.
Karan, I'll switch gears, and this is something that you briefly mentioned earlier. You mentioned obviously the credit engine, right? On the credit engine, on the consumer end, things are pretty clear. And now on the merchant end, I mean, I think it's pretty intuitive now that we hear that, you know, you're using the basically the transaction data or the payment data as a proxy to determine the credit worthiness. But the other engine that you mentioned was the fraud. And how do you deal with that, you know, both at the consumer level as well as at the merchant level? Because effectively, especially when it's unsecured credit, I'm assuming that you know, there's some amount of moral hazard which is, you know, built in, and especially when it is not even tied to a specific merchant partner, and the user is, you know, free to deploy the proceeds where he or she finds it appropriate. How do you view fraud?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, super interesting question. And let me break it down into two parts. There is the customer facing kind of frauds and the merchant facing kind of frauds. Two different beasts. Absolute different beast. The reality of being in the payments business and the credit business is, I think, especially being in a credit business where you're doing loans of this ticket sizes and in a digital fashion, the fraud piece is a lot more important than the credit piece,
right,
to be honest. Which we've simply realized that if you control the frauds, the credit will kind of take care of itself. You'll have data in about 6 months' time to know what worked, what didn't work. Okay, let me first talk about the consumer fraud, right? And we break it down into two. One is called identity fraud, and the other one is called, you know, intention fraud.
Right.
Identity fraud, some of it is proprietary, I won't be able to share, but what we've actually done is we've kind of put three or four triangulations into place. I'll take a simple example, which I think is quite prevalent, is customer declares his PAN card, he takes a photo of his Aadhaar, and he connects a bank account where he wants the money disbursed.
Right.
Now, at one level, forget about whether it is Karan Mehta himself applying or not. But if I've seen a PAN card, which I validated against the income tax department, that this PAN card belongs to Karan Mehta. If I got an Aadhaar card, which I validated against UDI, which does belong to Karan Mehta, and I have another bank account that does belong to Karan Mehta, at some level, I am very, very assured that the money is going into a legitimate customer's account, because I'm also piggybacking off of the bank's KYC.
Right.
That this bank must have done the right KYC for Karan Mehta, only then the account opened an account in the name of Karan Mehta. This works largely very, very accurately, except for recently you started seeing banks pop up in a very digital fashion where they will also open an account using the same Aadhaar and PAN.
Right.
So kind of that fails, and we've had to build, you know, metrics in place to say that these banks are the ones that have a very seamless method of account opening. So when a customer declares this bank, we'll have to add additional checks to this customer.
Right.
But at a top level, you do these right triangulations, and these triangulations can happen using the document, the customer uploaded document that looks legitimate or not, whether it's a Xerox, whether it's a photo of a photo, a lot of that, and you're able to OCR, and even we have heuristics on the document, which even a very, very good Photoshop version can be identified. We actually employ a technique which is, we try to identify whether within an image itself, the compression in different parts of the image is different from the other parts of the image, which allows us to identify whether this is a real Aadhaar card printed directly from the PDF of Aadhaar, or it was modified and then printed. Things like this, we've built some close to around 300 different fraud checks. Each of them is from a learning. A lot of it is from, you know, the preemptiveness of the analytics team. Some of it does just come from hard learnings. But this does work out very, very well. Now, for intention fraud, we again rely largely on digital data. Mm-hmm. We look at customers who've been applying for too many loans recently, who've not been paying their EMIs, who have large outstanding, who have, you know, significant income but still seeking a loan. We usually attribute all of those to intention frauds. And again, intention fraud has a lot of rules for us. Again, all of these signals, right? Each one signal cannot determine whether the customer is fraud or not. If I were to rely on independent signals, I would end up rejecting all of my customers because everyone intentionally or unintentionally violates some of the rules of fraud. Mm-hmm. So for fraud, what we've actually done is we've implemented a neural network, which is literally an artificial intelligence network, which learns programmatically. Every month, our collections team kind of sends back a set of cases which they are convinced are fraud. And this neural network of ours actually learns by just looking at patterns, which even we don't understand what patterns it has created. But it's actually able to do a very, very good job. Now we are able to do A/B testing on these customer sets. Some of the people that the engine says are likely fraud, we actually give them loans also, just right, to see whether the engine was correct or not. And we feed this back into the engine again. So it learns even smarter which of its predictions it got right and which ones of it did not get right. And this neural network has actually just amazed us. We've implemented this less than a year and a half back. Mm-hmm. It has paid us back many, many times over. And it's just an incredible piece of technology that we've developed. Mm-hmm. And super proud of the team that has put that into place.
Very interesting.
On the credit fraud, there are, you know, many, many learnings we've had, but since we are very, very new in the market, I'm sure there are many, many learnings for us to be had as well. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we've learned is the merchant level fraud is usually done in collusion with your own teams. Your sales and your onboarding teams are usually the culprits. Mm-hmm. So we've actually put in a lot of checks and balances in place, a lot of QC in place for these employees. Mm-hmm. And literally you have to manage a centralized command to see whether they are doing all the steps that they are supposed to do, track whether, you know, they are traveling where they are supposed to be traveling, and we do all of that through our sales app.
Mm-hmm. Oh, fairly interesting. And you know, just switching into slightly different domain here, just looking at the market, right? I mean, there are a lot of players, and everyone's tackling a different segment, I guess. And you guys obviously have found a credit gap and doing well. How do you see the industry evolve? I mean, just because there are so many microcredit lenders who are sort of, you know, trying to facilitate lending, do you see some kind of industry consolidation, or do you just think, like, you know, all of them will sort of grow and we're still very early in the game to even think about industry consolidation? Because, and people have identified different verticals as well, right? I mean, some are catering to students, some are catering for purchases, some are looking at even issuing loans for something as much as travel. I mean, complete flexibility. So how do you sort of see the industry evolve?
No, I think we are far, far away from consolidation. India is such a big, big, big pie, right? When you look at any industry estimates on the size of the lending pie for these underserved or unserved segments, mm-hmm. you will realize that you know, a new credit company popping up every day also would not be surprising, just mm-hmm. because that's the size of the Indian market. Mm-hmm. I believe consolidation, at least all of these companies, when you compare all of the new age lending players to the size of the books of, you know, HDFC or Bajaj, you'll realize that everyone is right now peanuts.
Yeah.
Nobody is even, you know, two orders of magnitudes closer to some of the larger players. Mm-hmm. I believe that there is going to be a lot of innovative players keep coming into the market. Some of them are going to steadily grow bigger. Mm-hmm. Right. And a lot of them will end up, you know, bringing innovative products but not able to find the right market traction or not able to sustain the business model. And I believe that this, you know, even this early discussions of consolidations will probably be at least 5 to 10 years away.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we have only sort of scratched the surface. One of the interesting, I think, you know, the thoughts I've always had is this combination of Aadhaar with eKYC, Jandan accounts, customers having smartphones and customers having very cheap data was literally setting up the foundation for a skyscraper. And all the products you're seeing right now, you know, your phone page, your Google page, your WhatsApp payment, Kish and early salaries and lazy pay and simples of the world, they are the first version of the innovation. They are some of the most obvious use cases that people are solving for.
Yeah.
We are even yet to see the more innovative ones. Something like travel finance, I'd put it in the innovative category.
Yeah.
You'll see a lot more products on top of these products. You'll have combinations of product between wealth management, investment, insurance, credit, everything together.
Mm-hmm.
And we will not be able to, right now, it'll be difficult for us to predict what are the market products that come out. But I believe another 5 or 10 years, we'll see that evolution of new generation of products. And I think right now, India is very fertile, both from a customer base and from an entrepreneur base.
Mm-hmm.
We have a large set of people who've been working corporate jobs, have been itching to get out into the startup world.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen a lot of these people make the jump in the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And this will bring out more innovative products. And I believe 5 or 10 years from now is when you'll see the real fintech industry take shape.
Mm-hmm.
Karan, like, and I guess to the question of Sharad, one bigger, I would say, variable is also the regulations. Effectively, you know, we can see various models at play, right? You, at one end of the spectrum, if you look at like traditional banking institutions, you have scheduled commercial banks, you know, who have very low cost of funding because they can kind of, you know, mobilize deposits. Then on in the middle, you have you know, bucket of fintech companies or neobanks who pretty much don't underwrite on their books, but they kind of have to partner with a traditional banking institution, and they kind of act as a, you know, loan origination model for the traditional banks. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have guys like, you know, like Kish. I guess Kish, like, you guys have your own NBFC and you lend on your own books, right? So you kind of have kind of parts of both the worlds in your business model. Which model do you see, you know, to kind of evolve into going forward? Because effectively, when lending has to be done at scale, it's all about cost of capital, right?
You're absolutely right. So let me address the regulation part in a bit, right? And let me also come to the cost of capital or the structure, the small or the big. On the regulation side, at least I will give super huge credits to RBI and both NPCI, because some of the products that we're launching deal with both RBI and NPCI.
Yeah.
I think they have been incredibly forward-looking. I think even this you know, recent discussion around fully digital bank licenses is just you know, showing us that RBI is keeping in sync with all the customer is wanting, what the industry wants to do. And it's incredibly forward thinking. I think RBI has played its role brilliantly, where it has made sure that certain checks and balances are placed. Now, your KYC norms, your customer grievance methodologies, your prevention of money laundering is never violated, no matter what you do. And as soon as someone does violate it, I think they come down on those companies like a hammer, which, you know, reflects that RBI is alert. It's not that it's passive, it's alert, but not actively meddling where it doesn't come in.
Right.
At the same time, I think RBI has let the market breathe. You know, something like what China did a couple of years ago, coming down to this hammer of saying that you can't have any APR of more than 36%, wiped out literally $1 trillion industry out of China. All of these Chinese players ended up setting up shop in other parts of the world, but could not do transactions in China anymore. Something like that is, I think, very short-sighted and very reactionary rather than well thought out of. And we really appreciate, you know, there was an RBI circular on digital lending.
Mm-hmm.
It laid out, so a lot of the points were put forward by this organization called FACE, of which Kish is a co-founder. It's an association of digital lenders.
Right.
We've actually been making a lot of the requests ourselves. We've been requesting that there are certain regulations that need to be put in place. Can you imagine there's a bunch of startups actually asking RBI for regulation?
Right.
But that was what it was. And RBI has been very, very careful, very, very thoughtful in evaluating all of these. And they've actually laid out the absolutely correct checks and balances, which are not burdening the customer, which are not taking away the ability for these lenders to do business, and yet bring in, you know, a fair ground for the consumers, so the consumers are not misled or not go into unsavory forms. So I think from the regulation perspective, we've been very, very optimistic that, you know, RBI has taken the right steps so far in the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That is what we expect to do. When it comes to, I think, fintechs, you know, with or without NBFC licenses and capital, something I predicted 3 years ago when we were, you know, doing massive volumes with Flipkart, I had predicted that in about 5 years' time, almost every company will have its own NBFC license in one shape or the form, some subsidiary,
right,
which I do still believe is another 2 or 3 years away, not
right.
more. You'll realize that Flipkart already has its own NBFC, MakeMyTrip will have its own NBFC, Amazon will have its own NBFC. Because one of the aspects I believe is a lot of the business models which are otherwise untenable become viable as soon as you add a lending element to it.
Right.
And I believe most of the companies are not going to make money from the primary business, but are probably going to make money from credit, whether it's in the form of buy now, pay later, or it's in the form of multiple EMIs. And hence you'll see a lot of them become NBFCs. Companies like Flipkart, anyways, have no dearth of capital.
Mm-hmm.
And their capital is, you know, a lot of times it's equity driven, so it's at 0% for them.
Yeah. But do you see a big tech entering lending as an opportunity or as a threat?
Big tech, and no, I would see that as an opportunity. I think someone like Flipkart, for example, will be very, very narrowly focused on, you know, using that as a additional source of income or additional source of consumer, you know, consumer benefit, but not will not be their primary model to go and acquire more customers or to acquire more revenue for that matter.
Right.
But I think lending by itself is a very, very tricky business. I think you have to, if you want to do it at a large scale, as in that's your primary business, then all, it will deserve all of your attention.
Mm, right.
It cannot be your secondary business model.
Right.
And yes, I believe, I think cost of capital has been a big differentiator for us. One of the reasons where you know, in the retail space, it was so difficult to compete with Bajaj because Bajaj's cost of capital is so incredibly low compared to any 5-6 year old NBFC that there is almost they can price you out. And the only way for us to survive was actually to, you know, address customers that Bajaj was not addressing.
Right.
If you are talking to the same customer that Bajaj is talking to, the customer is going to choose Bajaj hands down just by looking at the cost proposition.
Yeah, right. No, Karan, in terms of, you know, it's also very refreshing to hear a truly holistic perspective on the sector. So I would like to thank you for your time. And we definitely had a ball in this chat.
Yeah, it was
and,
fun.
And we definitely, you know, would be tracking Kesht closely and wish you, you know, all the best, bigger, better milestones going forward. And you know, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, guys. Thank you. I loved being here. It was super, super interesting to talk to you. And I think a very, very engaging conversation. So thank you for that, guys.
Yeah, it was fun. It was fun.
Cool, Karan. So with this, guys, this is the end of the hiatus, I would say. I just love using that word, I think.
I know.
And so this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.